Hi everybody, my name is Spencer. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm grateful to be sober today, and I'm grateful to be here. Thanks for having me. It's been a while. I didn't realize how long it had been since I've been at this meeting, but I'm grateful to be here tonight. I was thinking about what I wanted to talk about and read from in the book. And, you know, one of the things that's happened to me as a result of AA and as a result of doing the steps is that my idea of God changed completely. My conception of God changed completely. When I came to AA, and before I got to AA, I had this sort of like, I guess agnostic or atheist. I didn't believe in God, but the God that I didn't believe in was very specific. Like, I didn't believe in this God that I had like outlined and defined in some way, and then didn't believe in it. And what happened to me when I got to AA, in the simplest terms, is that this idea was presented to me that maybe my conception of God could be expanded to include things that I hadn't thought about before. And so I wasn't being asked to start believing in that old idea of God that I'd had before I got here. But I was asked to think about if there was a possibility that there was some kind of power or some kind of God that maybe I hadn't even conceived of before. And that was enough of a hole in the wall. Like, that was enough for me to sort of start thinking about a relationship to God in a new way. And it was a way for me to start doing the steps. And so that's what happened. So when I got here 17 years ago, I just had 17 years on June 11th. I was 25 years old. I had come to AA by way of a rehab that had said that they would kick me out if I didn't go to AA meetings. And then I had gotten into the rehab as a result of a family intervention, the family that said they would kick me out if I didn't go to rehab. And I had gotten that family intervention because I had gotten arrested yet again after attacking a police officer in a blackout. I had gone on this camping trip and gotten drunk, and like as usual, had started drinking that like Friday, drank all through the night Friday, woke up Saturday morning, was in a full blackout, was trying to go whitewater rafting, and the people that like ran the whitewater rafting place were like, no, like you can't get, you know, like you're drunk. It's 9 o'clock in the morning. Like, we're not letting you on a raft. And I'm like, let me, you know, I'm like fight yelling at everybody. I jump in the water. I'm going to do it myself. I'm going to go down the rapid myself. I'm like swimming out there. They have to come out and get me. This guy comes out in a kayak. Like, sort of, and I have a big mohawk at the time. It's like big blonde mohawk, big like hoop earrings. This guy like throws me over the front of the kayak, paddling back in. I start trying to fight him. They call the ranger, the police, right? Everybody comes. I start trying to fight them. They eventually subdue me, get me in the car. And the next thing I remember, you know, parts of that. But the next thing that I remember is kind of coming to, and I'm in a prison shower getting sprayed down with a hose. I have this, like, it's like delousing powder. It's almost like Comet, or what was that, like, that really rough, grainy, like, soap that they use? Yeah, they like, so it's like delousing powder, and they pour it all over you, and you have to, like, scrub it, and they're just spraying you down with this hose. And, you know, of course, all of my, you know, law and order training kicks in. I'm like, where's my attorney? And don't I have, you know, like, of course, all of a sudden, I'm now, like, have a degree in law. And they're like, you declined your right to an attorney. And I was like, when? They're like, this morning. It's like, this morning? They're like, yeah, when you went to court. And I was like, court? Yeah, they're like, when you told the judge to fuck himself. That was right about the time you declined your right to an attorney. And I didn't remember any of that. I didn't remember appearing in front of the judge. And, you know, that was sort of the end of like a long history of that kind of stuff, of ending up in situations that it didn't feel like who I was, but it was somehow who I always turned out to be. You know, I just like was always getting myself into these situations where I was either harm to myself or harm to other people. And I remember that having this kind of realization as they were walking me down. You know, they put me like in a jumpsuit, and I didn't end up staying in jail for very long. My sister was able to bail me out, but I did get like processed all the way through. And where they put me, I was in Uniontown Jail in Pennsylvania, and where they put me wasn't in like a drunk tank. It wasn't like a holding cell. It was in like a like cells with guys. I think the guy next to me had like 5 years that he was serving in jail, and so they're like walking me down this hall, and I've got shackles on my hands and my feet, and I remember having this thought, which is like, I'm in the wrong place. You know what I mean? Like this isn't like where I'm supposed to be. And then the follow up thought was like, oh, there are not two kinds of jails. There's not jails for like bad people who have done bad things, and then a different jail for people like me who are good people but just accidentally did something wrong when they were drinking. You know, there's like one jail, and actually, I did belong there. You know, I did. I was a threat to myself and to other people, and I think that was a real awakening to me. But it certainly would not have been my last drink, because I had had so many times where I had like near-death experiences, I had trouble with the law, I got lost jobs, I got kicked out of, like there's so much trouble from alcohol, and it was never the last time. And so when I got to AA, right, the three things I heard somebody, Sandy Beach said this in a talk one time. He said, there's three things that AA teaches you when you get here. The first is this idea of powerlessness, that we're powerless over alcohol. And it was really like new information to me. Because I thought that I was powerless over alcohol once I started drinking it. Like that I was very aware of. Like when I would start drinking, I would totally lose control. I was a maniac. I would drink until I blacked out or somebody stopped me or passed out or whatever. But I did not understand this idea that I was powerless over the first drink. And it wasn't until I got to AA and just started to read the book that idea started to make sense to me. That the real problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than in his body. Right? I always just thought it was like a problem of my drinking. Right? When I'm drinking, when I start drinking, but it never occurred to me that I was sober when I took the first drink. And that I had like all the awareness of all these consequences of my drinking. And yet, just with like the most casual thought, I would just start again. There was nothing could come into my mind to stop me. Right? That there was no thought that was powerful enough to come into my consciousness to stop me from picking up the first drink. And when I really understood that, which wasn't until I got to AA, when I really understood that, I think I was desperate in a way that I hadn't been before. Like I really understood how much I was screwed. Because left to my own devices, I had seen over and over and over again, left to my own devices, I was absolutely going to pick up a drink again. No matter how bad the consequences got, no matter what had happened to me, no matter, like, none of it mattered. There was no self-knowledge, there was no self-will, there was no amount of determination, there was nothing that could stop me from picking up the first drink. And so the second thing that AA teaches us is it teaches us this idea of a solution to that problem, and the solution is a power, right? If we're powerless, then what we need is a power. And it presents this idea, which I think it does pretty well in the book, and we're going to talk a little bit about it. It presents this idea of a power. Now, the thing for me, again, as like a sort of rebellious agnostic or atheist coming in here, the problem with that was that I didn't believe in God. And because I didn't believe in God, I thought that the solution of finding God was unavailable to me. So I was sort of in this place where I recognized that I was screwed because I was left to my own devices, I would definitely pick up a drink. But I also felt like the solution to that problem, which I've been presented with, was like not a solution that would work for me. I was like, what am I supposed to do? Right? And it wasn't like I had a problem with God. Like I wasn't angry about it. It just felt like I used to say Santa Claus. So I said this, when people get mad if I talk about Santa Claus not being real. It like the Easter Bunny. Like that's how it felt to me. Right? It just felt like totally made up. Like God just felt pretend. And so the idea, like I was even willing, I remember saying to my sponsor, my first sponsor, like if you want me to pretend, like if pretending will save my life, I will do it. Like I will pretend to believe in God. But like I actually don't. I just like, I want you, I'm supposed to tell you everything. I just want you to know that I actually don't believe in it. And he was like, he's great. His name is Marlon. He's passed away, but he was such a kind and wise person. And he just laughed and he was like, yeah, no, don't, you can pretend all you want. Don't worry. You just keep coming back and pretend and don't worry about it. Everything else will take care of itself. You just keep pretending. And so the third thing, right, this is what Sandy Beach talks about in his talk. The third thing that AA does for us, which is really, really helpful for somebody like me, is the third thing that AA does is it takes us through this set of simple steps. It takes us from a place of being powerless to a place of being connected. So that we don't have to come to believe in a power greater than ourselves on our own, right? I don't have to like have an academic or an intellectual experience of God. I don't have to figure out how to define God or make sense of God. Right? I don't have to have the words for God. All I have to do is follow the instructions that are laid out in the steps, and as a result of following those instructions, what will happen to me and what did happen to me, and I know from conversations with other people it's happened to them too, is that I had an experience of God. So it was like, unlike anything that I ever imagined God being, right? It wasn't like, it didn't match up with the God that I disagreed with. It didn't match up with the God I didn't believe in. It was like a brand new thing. I remember going to a lecture one time and they talked about these three categories of things. The three categories of things are the things that we know, right? Like I know where I live, I know my address. The things that we know we don't know, right? Like, I know I don't know how to speak French. And for most of my life, those are the only two categories I operated in, right? It was what I knew and what I didn't know. And he said, no, there's an entirely separate category, which is bigger than both of those categories combined. And it's what you don't know, you don't know. And that is the category that became available to me as I started to go through the steps. Because what happened is I started to become aware that off the side of like the things I knew I didn't know, there was this whole other thing available to me, which were things that I had not even considered yet. Now, when I read the part of the book I wanted to read from is on page 55 in We Agnostics. And I remember reading We Agnostics the first time and being like, nope, 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 nope. Like, not for me. Y'all are trying to sell me on something that I don't believe in. Not having it, right? And even all the different ways that they talked about God, I just felt like over the top, like too much sort of like purple prose, flowery descriptions. It wasn't for me. But there's this passage on 55. It says, actually, we were fooling ourselves. For deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. It may be obscured by calamity, by pomp, by worship of other things, but in some form or other, it is there. For faith in a power greater than ourselves, and miraculous demonstrations of that power in human lives are facts as old as man himself. We finally saw that faith in some kind of God was a part of our makeup, just as much as the feeling we have for a friend. Sometimes we had to search fearlessly, but he was there. He was as much a fact as we were. We found the great reality deep down within us. In the last analysis, it is only there that he may be found. It was so with us. And this idea of the great reality is what I want to talk about tonight. Because I think that when I got to AA, when I first got here and I was first getting sober, I was very much being introduced to reality in general. Right? Prior to AA, prior to getting sober, I was like, I think, what do they say? Full flight from reality, right? It's just like I couldn't even get to that. I couldn't even admit to what was like in front of me, right? I was like so, like things were so twisted in my perspective of the world that I couldn't even kind of like accept or appreciate what actually like existed in a tangible and real way, right? Whether that was a relationship or whether that was like stuff or whether that was like my point of view of the world. Right? It just like, it was so warped. And so when I got to AA, almost immediately, I started to have a relationship with reality, you know? And that was great. And there's a lot of things about that relationship to reality that were really helpful and healthy. But that's not like the great reality, right? That's not like the transformation that we're talking about. Right, I was thinking about this yesterday, what's like an analogy I could use to describe this? It's like if I went to a restaurant and I ordered a turkey sandwich and they brought out a bowl of soup and I said, I'm sorry, this is like a bowl of soup, I ordered a turkey sandwich. And they said, yeah, well, you know what, we don't make turkey sandwiches anymore, like all we got is soup. Right? If that happened to me in early sobriety, if that happened to me before I came to AA, I would have flipped the table, right? Like, full, like, lack of acceptance of what's actually happening. Like, I just would have, like, I mean, I would have thrown a fit. I wouldn't even imagine how somebody could do that. You said you had a turkey sandwich, you don't have a turkey, you're bringing me something that's totally different, right? I would have freaked out. But in early AA, if that had happened, right, I would have done this kind of, you know, what people say to you all the time when you first get sober, just let it go, right? Which to me is like the worst thing to hear. Because you're like, let go, like how? What do you mean let go, right? But let's say I was with a sober person at this table, they bring me the wrong thing, the person would be like, just let it go, right? And I would have, right? I would have said, okay, let me accept this reality. The reality is, the restaurant doesn't have a turkey sandwich. Right? That's what I wanted. I'm disappointed, but they don't have it. And so what it means to accept reality, right? To live in reality means that I have to say, like, okay, you don't have the thing that I wanted. I'm not going to get what I want. Maybe I'm disappointed about it, but I can like move on. I can leave. I can go to a different restaurant. I can just eat the soup, right? There's a lot of things I can do, right? And that's that first level of a relationship to reality that we get in sobriety. But that's not the great reality. That's not that kind of transformational experience, right? So if we look at that same diner where I order this sandwich, same restaurant, but we look at it from the perspective of what happens to somebody as they do the steps, right? What we learn in the steps, specifically 4 through 7 or 4 through 9, is that whenever we are disturbed, no matter the disturbance is with us. Now see, when I first got to AA, or before I got to AA, the problem in that situation is not me. The problem in that situation is this restaurant. It's that they brought me the wrong thing. That's the problem. So even if I like accept the reality of the problem, I am walking out of there feeling like they are the problem. That's not a solution. That's not transformational. That doesn't change my life. Right? That's me assigning the problem onto somebody else. That is the world being the problem, and I can't live in the world that is a problem. Because ultimately, I'm gonna come up against something that I can't accept. Like, maybe I can get by with, like, eating the soup instead of the sandwich. But at some point, I'm going to be in a relationship, or somebody's going to die, or something is going to go down in my life that I cannot deal with in that way. I can't just let it go. But what the steps say is it's not the problem of the restaurant. It's not the problem of the soup. None of that is the problem. If I am disturbed, no matter the disturbance is with me. So what's going on in that restaurant when I don't get the sandwich that I ordered is that I am the problem. So what we look at in that fourth step is like, first column, this restaurant. Second column, they didn't bring me the sandwich. They lied to me, whatever, right? Third column, what does it affect? Well, there's probably people around, right? Other people in the restaurant, so status, like what other people think of me. Wow, they didn't even get that guy a sandwich. Like, he must be a real loser. They're not even getting what he wants, right? My own self-esteem, my self-worth, right? Probably cost money. So financial security somewhere in there, maybe. Let's say that there's somebody in the restaurant I'm attracted to. Maybe it's the person that's at the table. Maybe it's the person bringing me the food, right? Somebody there. Sex relations, right? So all of a sudden, these things start to be, in that third column, we start to see like why this situation that's just about soup and a sandwich is like really intense, right? It's because it affects all these parts of my life that actually really matter. So by the time we get to the fourth column, we're no longer talking about a sandwich. What we're talking about is that I am afraid that I am not, that my needs are not going to be met. I am afraid that I'm not going to get what I want. Maybe I'm afraid that I'm not worthy, that I'm not good enough to get what I want. Right? Maybe I'm thinking about like, gosh, if this was Oprah or LeBron James, and they walked into this restaurant, they would bring the turkey sandwich. Somebody would run next door and kill a turkey and make a sandwich and bring it back. But I'm not worth that kind of effort. Right? That's what it means to have low self-worth, is that you imagine these situations, you imagine these circumstances that tell a story that matches what you believe about yourself. It doesn't matter if it's true or not. What matters is that I feel like I'm not worthy, and as a result of that, I have told some story that matches how I feel. So now, as a result of doing the steps, where we've landed is that I am now in the fourth column. I'm not talking about the sandwich. The restaurant is not the problem. What I'm looking at is I'm saying, I am afraid. I am afraid I'm not going to get what I want. I'm afraid I'm not going to be taken care of. I am afraid I'm not worthy. And when I look at those things, then all of a sudden, I have the opportunity to really actually get free. Because I can't change the restaurant. I can't change what other people are doing in the world. But I can myself get free of those things. Right? And that's what we start to do in the fifth step when we share that with somebody else. In the sixth step when we become willing to disconnect those things. Right? When we say, we look at the way in which we use those defects of character to our advantage. Right? Why am I so mad? Right? That's the question I ask myself in the sixth step. Why am I so mad about this turkey sandwich? Why does it matter? Why don't I stop being mad? Well, there's an answer for me, right? The answer is, if I stop being mad, it will show that I don't care about the result. When I was like 2.5 years sober, I was desperate to be in a relationship. I mean, just absolutely desperate. I had done, like, to a T, exactly what you're supposed to do in AA. Like, every single thing I was supposed to do, I had done. And I thought that as a result of doing everything that I was supposed to do in AA, I was going to get the things that I wanted. And what I desperately wanted was to be in a relationship. So every meeting I would go to, I'd raise my hand. I'd be like, I'm lonely. I don't have a boyfriend. I'm lonely. And I mean, people were sick of it. You know what I mean? People just like had enough of it. And after like weeks, months probably of this, this guy Jack pulled me outside after the meeting and he said, listen. He said, can I ask you a question? I said, yeah. He said, why don't you stop being angry? And I was like, what do you mean? He's like, well, every week you come in here and you complain about being so lonely. Why don't you just stop? Just give it up. Stop feeling all this despair. Stop feeling all this anger. Stop feeling all this loneliness. Why don't you just stop being lonely? And I was like, man, are you even listening to me? Like, I'm lonely because I'm not in a relationship. I need to get in a relationship so I stop feeling lonely. And he's like, yeah, but you might not ever get in a relationship. So if you don't want to feel lonely, why don't you just stop feeling lonely? I've never been so close to punching somebody. I mean, I was so mad at this guy because he just kept asking again and again, why don't you just stop being lonely? And finally, I answered the question and I heard myself. I heard the answer. I said, if I stop being lonely, it would mean I don't want to be loved. And I realized in that moment, and this is what he was trying to get me to, is that the loneliness served to me as evidence that I wanted to be loved. So there was a purpose. And he said, well, of course you're not going to stop being lonely. That loneliness is way too important to you. You think if you stop being lonely, that you'll never get that boyfriend. You think if you stop being lonely, if you stop feeling loneliness, then the signal to the world that you want to love someone and be loved in return will be gone. He's like, so instead of stopping being lonely, he's like, you are going to be more and more and more lonely. You are going to wave your flag of loneliness as loudly as you can. Because the more people understand that you are lonely, the more that people will understand that you want to be loved. And he said, and until you can disconnect those two things, you'll never stop being lonely. He said, do you think that it's possible that you could just know that you want to be loved without feeling lonely? Well, I said, yeah, I think actually I could. Like, I think there have been moments where I have recognized that, like, I actually just want to be loved. He said, great. So then the seventh step, just put it into a, customize the prayer, right, for the seventh step. God, in freedom from loneliness and despair, keep me aware simply of my desire to love and be loved. And anytime I felt that loneliness or that despair sink in, I just said that prayer. God, in freedom from loneliness and despair, keep me aware simply of my desire to love and be loved. And what I recognized was that that desire to love and be loved already existed within me, and that the loneliness was a tool that I was using to prove the existence of that thing. Right? So those character defects that we talk about are like useless tools of self-reliance. Right? It is an attempt for me, my ego, myself, right, to make sure that I get everything that I want. And the attempt to get everything I want happens as a result of living in these defects of character. So all of the defects of character that I feel, fear, shame, envy, all of it ultimately shows me, points me to something that is trying to, some evidence, some proof, right? Some desire that it's pointing to that already exists, but that I feel like if I don't have that envy, that shame, that fear, that anger, right? It's like road rage, to me is such a clear example of this, right? Like somebody cuts me off on the road, I got all my kids in the car, they almost kill me, and immediately I'm angry, right? Well, what if I wasn't angry? What if I was just like, oh, that's okay, don't worry, just get right on in, even though you almost killed me, right? Of course I'm angry. I'm angry because what they just did threatens everything that's important to me in my life. It threatens my actual life, it threatens my kids' life, right? So the anger is a way for me to have evidence that those things are really important. So if somebody cuts me off the road, what I need to immediately do, and what I try to do immediately, although it does not always work, is God and freedom from anger keep me aware simply of my desire to live, for my kids to be alive, for me to be safe and protected. Because when I'm living in that place, just knowledge of the thing, the anger serves no purpose. What good is the loneliness if it points to nothing? Right? If I just live in the awareness that I want to love and be loved, there's nowhere for the loneliness to land. Right? It serves me no purpose. And when the purpose has been removed, then the healing is instantaneous. Right? And that doesn't mean that this is like a parlor trick, right? It's not like a like you could just like wipe away anything anytime, right? Because most things, as you guys I'm sure know, most things that we come up against are so nuanced, right? They're not a turkey sandwich and a bowl of soup, right? They're like incredibly complex resentments that involve like people that we have like a lot of history with, or things that are like deep rooted and not clear. I think about this with my husband, right? Like, if you inserted my husband into like the turkey sandwich analogy, it would not be my husband coming out and saying like, "We don't have the turkey sandwich. Here's the soup." It would be my husband coming out and being like, "We have the turkey sandwich. We're not going to give it to you. Actually, you know what? We will give it to you, but it's going to take a while. Well, actually, you know what? That's fine. You can just have it right. You want it right now? Yeah. Here, here's the turkey sandwich and the soup, and like, and then it comes back, and then like, and then takes it away halfway through I'm eating it. You know, like it's not like it's not as clear, right? It's not like it's not that metaphor where it's just like, oh yeah, that's easy, right? I see this very clear resentment, and then we just right. It's like these. It's these like nuances and layers of complicated relationships. But at the core of it for me has always been this idea that if you can, that if I can get back to the thing that disturbs me, not the problem in the world, not the fact that the restaurant doesn't serve the turkey sandwiches, or the person cut me off, or the fact that nobody wants to go on a date with me and I'm lonely, right? If I don't have to worry about the problems in the world that are aggravating me, I can just look at the thing that is disturbing me, and I can look at like how does that point to the thing that I want in the world. And so when I look at this idea of like a great reality, what for me, right, what I've experienced is that that truth that these defects of character point to, right, that truth. Like, the defect of loneliness, for me, pointed to this truth about myself that I wanted to love and be loved. And I discovered that truth, that I wanted to love and be loved, as a result of doing the steps. Right? As a result of doing those steps, I discovered that my loneliness, that defect of character that I started with, that felt like everybody else's fault, turned out was just like, pointed to this desire in myself to love and be loved. And the thing about that desire is that I did not create it, nor can I take credit for it. That desire exists within me. And this is, I think, when I think about the great reality, that is the thing. Sitting at that table, mad about whether it's a soup or a sandwich. That's the great reality. That's the transformation that I'm able to have. Right, is not that I can let go of that situation. It's that I can become aware of the fact that my desire to be taken care of, my desire to be loved, my desire to be well treated, my desire to be respected, that those things are not things that I invented in myself. That those things themselves are a power which is greater than myself. Right? That those things I did not create or control. I had a party, and I have a party, right? And I invite God to the party, right? And God shows up, and God has made this like perfect cake, like it's beautiful. It's like everything about the cake is exactly right. And God comes in and gives me the cake. And I take the cake, and I go back into the kitchen, and somehow between the time God handed me the cake and I got to the kitchen, I got this crazy idea in my head that I needed to like make the cake. I have to participate in this. It can't just be that like I am okay as I am. It can't just be that this cake is like can just go out to all of these guests at my party. Right, so I start like breaking off chunks of this cake and putting it in the mixer, and like there's like flour and milk and eggs, and it's like a total disaster, right? And God walks into the kitchen, and is like, "What are you doing?" I'm like, "I'm I know you brought a cake, and I'm just trying to like swirl it up a little bit. You know what I mean? Like, we got to like make it really good to serve to people. And God is like, no, the cake was already made. Like, cake was fully made. All you had to do is serve. And then this is the thing that gets me caught up, right? Yes, but when I serve it, what am I going to say to the people that ask me who made the cake? Because it is terrifying to think of not being able to take credit for my own goodness. That's like what I ultimately want. I don't want to just be good. I want to be good as a result of my own doing. That's what those defects of character allow me to do. They allow me to get credit for being good. Can I just know that I want to be loved and end up in a relationship? No. I have to be lonely. I have to be angry. I have to be afraid. I have to be so afraid that I'm never going to end up in a relationship, that fear motivates me to find a relationship and get into one. And then when I'm finally in that relationship, I can say that I got there because I worked hard for it. Right? Because it was some effort that I put in. That my ego gets to take credit for anything that I do and everything that I accomplish, my ego takes credit. Right? Unconditional love is like, I don't want it. Right? I want conditional love. I want you to love me because of how good I am and how hard I've tried. And to just fully give up credit for our goodness is, I think, like the most impossible thing. To just say, like, to God be the glory. Like, wow, Spencer, you did a great job tonight. Well, it wasn't me. You know? Oh, wow, Spencer, you did an amazing job on that project. It wasn't me. Right? Not that it wasn't me that I put in the effort or that I tried or that I put pen to paper. But that it didn't come from me as that thing, right? That like the desire, that like drive to be, that thing that drives us to exist, to want, to love, that did not come from me. That exists without my permission. The same guy, Jack, that walked me through the 4 through 7 in the steps around loneliness, he also would do this thing where he'd say, okay, Spencer, hold out your hand. Okay, now flip it over. Okay, now flip it over again. He said, great. You're doing a great job at following instructions. He's like, when your brain tells your body to do something, it works perfectly. He said, now put your hand on your heart. He said, feel your heartbeat. Okay, now tell your heart to stop beating. Can't. He said, that's the power I'm talking about. Right? Like, yeah, sure, our brain has the ability to, like, our mind has the ability to, like, instruct us, make us do something. But what I'm tapped into is some force of life, right, that we all have access to. Some force of life that exists within us without our permission, without our control, whether we want it to or not. I remember going through the steps that with Marlon, my first sponsor, and getting to this this one column or row. There was a group that I really never thought I would find. I don't even think I was thinking about forgiveness, but like softness for, right? Like I've been in college, and I was on the train, subway, and I was with my boyfriend at the time, and these four guys were on the train, and they were sort of teasing my boyfriend, and it escalated, and they started calling him faggot, and then they were getting off the train, right? And I went to the train doors, and I stood in the train doors, and I was like, if you're going to say faggot, why don't you come back and say it to my face? And the train doors shut. It was actually Metro. It wasn't Subway. I don't know if the Subway cars do this either. But Metro, when the door's shut, they don't reopen. They're not like an elevator where it just pops open. So the door, somebody's controlling, right? So the door just shuts, and I've got one arm inside the train and one arm pinned to the side of my body, and these four guys just coming right back across the platform. And they just destroyed me. I mean, just smashed my face in, broke my nose, blood everywhere. I got taken to the hospital, and by the time I got sober, it had happened like a couple years before, right? It had been a while, but I could not think of that moment without feeling that intense level of like resentment against these guys. And as I was doing the steps, I was sort of in my head, I was thinking like, well, this is going to be the one that my sponsor says, well, yeah, that was their fault. You can skip that one. You know? Right? Like, all these other ones, like, oh, yeah, you're mad at this person. You gotta get rid of that, right? That's like, you're disturbed, the disturbance is you. But certainly not these guys that attacked me and put me in the hospital and smashed my face. That's the one that we're going to get to, that one. And my sponsor's going to be like, oh, yeah, well, that's just awful that they did that. And we got to that one, and he did say, that's awful that they did that. He said, if you're disturbed, the disturbance is with you. It does not matter the disturbance. It doesn't matter what happened. He's like, we're not talking about what happened on the train. That was a long time ago. What we're talking about is you right now. There's something that exists in you right now that isn't allowing you to be free. So that's what we're trying to find. Right? And so we put it into the steps. Right? And in the first column, it's these guys that attacked me. Right? The second column, it's because they attacked me. In the third column, it's all of it. Right? My boyfriend was there, so it's sex relations. It's like cost me a lot of money to get an ambulance, so it's that. It's there's a lot of people around, so it's what people thought of me. It's a whole lot of self-worth. Right? Because when you get beat up like that, like you feel like a loser. And then I got to the fourth column. And the fourth column was a whole lot of fear. It was fear that I wasn't enough, right? That I couldn't stand up for myself, I couldn't stand up for my boyfriend. It was fear that like I was gonna spend my whole life being attacked. It was fear that like all the people who had ever said anything like that to me in my life were right. It was fear that, like, I wasn't worthy, that I wasn't good enough. And so in the fifth step, when I shared that, and then in the sixth step, when I became willing to have that defect of character removed, I'm not asking for, like, the situation to be resolved. I'm not asking for, like, some kind of fix to that horrible thing that happened to me. What I'm asking for is that I can disconnect those feelings of fear with my knowledge that I want to be taken care of, that I want to be okay, that I want to be able to walk through the world and be safe and feel okay. Right? And that's what happened. I did that seven-step prayer, and I felt totally transformed from that experience. I could literally think about them. I can think about them right now. I can think about those guys. And there's not a single feeling, ill feeling in my body. Like there is nothing about me that wishes them ill. There is nothing about me that even like wonders who they are or where they are. Like it's just gone. Right? That experience is just gone from me. And it's gone not because I like figured out how to solve the circumstance. It's gone because I got free of the thing that was holding me back. Like the thing within me that I was stuck on. That fear. So when I'm looking at like the great reality, I'm not talking about the idea that I'm somehow going to be able to like superficially let something go. Right? Oh, you know what? Just like, just accept it. That's reality. You just gotta deal with it. Great. And listen, That's not a bad place to start. But ultimately what I'm looking for is something more profound than just the ability to accept tangible reality as it is. What I'm looking for is a way to transform my relationship with the world so that I can live in acceptance of whatever happens. No matter how intense, no matter how bad, no matter how terrifying that thing is. And also, by the way, no matter how mundane that thing is. Because in some ways, what I've learned being married and now having three kids is that, fortunately, knock on wood, a lot of my stress and drama is not particularly dramatic. It's like the kids fighting over what TV show to watch. And I'm like really aggravated. Like the highest levels of aggravation I've ever felt in my life are the result of like them not wanting to eat what I put on the plate for dinner. Right? So we're not talking about like needing to use this mechanism in the steps just when things are like as bad as they get. Like this mechanism in the steps is about like I need to be finding my way to the great reality at dinner time with the three kids, right? Like I don't just need it in these times that are really traumatic or tragic, and certainly it's helpful there and has been helpful for me there. But like I need to live that every day. And you know, the thing for me about this idea of the great reality, and this is what it says in this passage, is that it's this idea that God is already within us. And that what the steps do is not to add onto an idea of God, but they clear away all of this other stuff, like the pomp and circumstance, right? All of the other stuff that stands in the way of my ability to see and experience God in the way that God already exists in my life. Right? Just my conception. All of this, just my conception. But I don't see that I have ever been disconnected from God. I don't think I ever have been, and I don't think I ever will be. I think it's impossible for me to be disconnected from God. What I think it's very possible is that I lose sight of that connection. Right? That things are happening in my life in a way that don't allow me to experience or be aware of God that is always and will always be present. And so what I'm looking to do through the steps and through my connection to AA and through service to other people is not to kind of like create God in the world. It's just to like become again and again and over again aware of that connection which already exists. And that, I think, is a great place to stop. That's all I got.